Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Morning show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's the Ailish Hour, hour four of the podcast. If you're listening to the Fan Morning Show podcast, thank you. Subscribe, download, five stars. You can listen to all 3 hours previous to this. We had some great guests on. Our guy, Charles Davis, my favorite. Well, one of my favorites. I can't claim that now when I'm about to have two guests on. But one of the top 10 guests that we have on the morning show. Great to have him back after a long NFL offseason. That interview 6:30. We had Jeff Blair on, who I'm going to see momentarily. Tim Leeper. Lots of Blue Jays talk. that was something that happened this weekend. The Toronto Blue Jays played games. Let's move on from that sentence. There are some positives that happened this weekend. The National Bank Open wrapped up. Simona Halep, third National Bank Open title, or Rogers Cup title as well. She spoke really highly of the crowd in Toronto, especially as the Romanian fans that came to support her. She says there's lots in Toronto. If you watch the game, you could tell she was probably the favorite just by a bit. We will be talking to Carolyn Cameron next just to break all this down. And on the men's side, Pablo Carreño Busta, first unseeded player to win the National Bank Open since 2002. So some great storylines coming out of tennis this weekend. A little bit of a hiatus, some tournaments, but no Grand Slams until the U.S. Open, which is just over 2 weeks away. So we'll definitely be talking some U.S. Open when that comes. Other positives this weekend, a little weekend roundup. TFC, absolutely on fire as of late. Unbeaten in four games since the Italians joined. Pushing that playoff position. They're only 4 points back. We're going to talk to James Sharman as well on the show. Get a little bit of a TFC recap. What's clicking for them? But one of the most exciting moments of the weekend for a Toronto sports fan was Insigne scored his first goal at BMO Field. I know he scored a couple, but was waiting for him to get that BMO Field atmosphere, and it was electric.
Support from Insigne out wide. Lorenzo Insigne up against Van Rankin. This is Jaden Nelson. Now Michael Bradley over the top. Lorenzo Insigne trying to get on it. It's Lorenzo Insigne! It's Toronto back in front. And El Magnifico scores his first in front of the home fans here at BMO Field. Goals in back-to-back games for Lorenzo Insigne. And with a little over 10 minutes remaining, 2-1 Toronto.
Man, it's fun to be a TFC fan anytime, but especially right now. So text in 590, 590 if you were there. What the atmosphere has been like at BMO Field. I haven't got down for a game myself, but there's still more to come. So we'll talk to James Sharman after the midway break of the Ailish Hour. More positives this weekend. Buffalo Bills played their first preseason game. They won. They're undefeated. Planned the parade. You saw it. The 82-yard punt by the punt god. Things are just looking good. Okay, things are looking good. Let's keep with the positives. Covering an incredible tournament for us all week at the National Bank Open, Carolyn Cameron, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to talk to you because I want to say you did an incredible job at the tournament this week. I don't know if it was your first time doing tennis, but the first time that I'd really been so invested in it, and I just want to say, amazing job, very much a natural, and I really enjoyed listening to you.
Oh, thanks, Ailish. I appreciate it.
How different is that for you versus doing like the hockey season? Is the day-to-day just a complete 360?
Yeah, it's just really long. Like we did 25 matches, called 25 matches over 7 days. Oof. Especially at the start of the tournament, like you're just on air for, honestly, it's 14 hours. So it's more so just like trying to not lose your voice.
I sound
like I had a really rough weekend, but I was just calling tennis.
Yeah, I know that feeling. But you sound great. So thanks for joining us. I know you probably want to have a little bit of a break, but appreciate you coming on for some insight. So most interesting, I know you said you covered 25 matches, but most interesting storyline that you got to cover throughout the whole week?
Ooh, I think when, like, usually you kind of build towards the final and that's kind of the moment of the tournament. But for me, it was definitely Wednesday night with Serena saying her goodbye, having just announced her retirement the day before, and losing to Belinda Bencic, and then it was the teary goodbye, and it was just so cool, and we're so lucky as Torontonians and just here in Canada that we were able to kind of share some of her really brief farewell tour. So that was really special. And then right after the Serena match, it was Bianca. Mm-hmm. So in terms of like my years just even going to the tournament and covering it, I think that was one of the biggest nights, not just of this tournament, but of the tournament in its history too. I heard too, in terms of like sales, is they did as well in that one night as they usually do over the course of an entire tournament. So it was just so cool. But it was also strange because you're coming off this weird kind of teary-eyed emotional send-off for Serena. And then even you could tell the fans had a bit of trouble getting back up for Bianca. And it took a little bit of time in that match. But yeah, that was a really memorable match or night and two matches.
I know you mentioned the ticket sales for the National Bank Open went up, but also the U.S. Open says they sold 15,000 more tickets after she announced that she'd be retiring post that tournament. Like, how incredible is that finale going to be for her career?
Oh, my gosh. It's going to be insane. And then the one tournament she has before the U.S. Open is this week in Cincinnati, and she faces Emma Raducanu, who's the U.S. Open champ from a year ago. And what's so cool about that is it's going to be their first career meeting, and you've got Serena, who's getting ready to say goodbye against like one of the young stars just starting her career. So that's going to be incredible. And I'm sure, like, for Belinda Bencic playing Serena, she has more experience and she's beaten Serena before. And even though right now Emma's playing better tennis and is in better shape than Serena is, I think that's going to be a hard emotional match for Raducanu to kind of try and beat Serena. And then the U.S. Open, I honestly can't even imagine. It's just going to be nuts. And it's going to be, like, especially if she wins a match or two.
Oh, boy.
Because that's where in Toronto, we're kind of, even before we went on air, it's like, okay, yeah, it is her goodbye, but we can't be opening with, like, this is it, because she could win the match, and then we just, like, what are you going to do every 2 days? Be like, okay, maybe this is it. So it's going to be, but New York, it's just going to be nuts.
When you think about this momentum or this, like, type of emotional boost she might have, do you think that affects, I know she's a professional and she's very, like, stoic, but how much do you think that actually could help propel her to at least one or two victories, even though she's not in her prime right now?
I think the thing with Serena is you can never, and it's cliche, but you can just never count her out. Like, she's just so powerful. So even if she's not in her best form, she's still able to kind of like grind out matches just by using like her power from the baseline and her serve. So I think we can't underestimate just emotionally what this could mean for her and how she wants to finish strong. That was one thing that I shouldn't say surprised me on the Wednesday night when she beat Bencic, but you could tell she was kind of like peeved after the match. Like, sure, it was the goodbye, but she was pretty upset that she lost that match, which I think just goes to show, like, even as she wrote in Vogue, she doesn't want to retire and say goodbye, but she knows it's time. But there's still, even though it's this goodbye, it's not like for her, it's this, I'm going to sail off into the sunset and I don't care how the results are. She wants to win on her way out.
I wonder, I know this is a lot forward thinking, but she's going to evolve into the next part of her career, obviously spend some time with family. And she, you know, mentioned trying to have another kid or being able to have, you know, additions to her family. Do you think that she has some sort of return to tennis down the road, whether that's in broadcasting or coaching or helping with the WTA? Like, do you see that for her, or is this kind of a great end to the career?
Yeah, I doubt it. And I was even talking just off air to Tracy Austin, who I was doing the broadcast with, about this. I think Serena is going to be one of those people who kind of just disappears from tennis. Like, I could see her maybe showing up the odd time at the U.S. Open or maybe Wimbledon if there's a big event. But I don't think she'll be around tennis that much. She has just so many other things on the go, like Serena Ventures, and like she's so into business and entrepreneurship. So it's not like she's going to disappear in terms of we're not going to see her. I just don't think we're going to see her around tennis.
Yeah.
I think after that's kind of it.
Yeah, I agree with that narrative. I think it'd be just a very interesting transition for her. And the fact that she's been so outwardly spoken, even in the Vogue article, about wanting a little bit of a break from it, I feel like that's a hint at least that don't count on me coming back. But anyway, so Serena, you got to see that pretty emotional farewell to Toronto, but then you got to cover the rest of the tournament with Simona Halep winning just after the whole year that she had. She fell out of the top 10 for the first time in like 7 years last year. And she misses some really significant matches and some significant tournaments. She had the calf injury. So how impressive has this return this year been for her?
Yeah, it's been really cool. And it's kind of interesting right now in women's tennis because I already referenced Emma Raducanu. Like, mm-hmm. she's one of these young stars, like Leilani Fernandez and Coco Gauff, who's still a teenager. Like, it's this next wave. And they're all dealing right now very vocally, and Bianca Andreescu, too. They're dealing with the pressure of, okay, I've kind of made it, and now people expect that of me, and I expect it of myself. And we're seeing some of them struggle and just even struggle personally or emotionally, I should say, in terms of trying to understand what their average play is and who they are and where they fit in on tour. Then you have someone like Simona Halep, who is 30 years old now, and last year she had a calf injury that made her just question, like, do I really want to do this anymore, or am I done? And I thought it was interesting that she said, like, as everyone heard who was watching the tournament this week, she started just a few months ago working with Serena's longtime coach, Patrick mm-hmm. Mouratoglou. And Halep said there was a certain moment at his academy where she just saw these kids, like, grinding it out, and they're at practice, and they're really, like, just working hard because they want to make it one day. And she realized that she'd already fulfilled that dream, but that she still had more in her. So I think it's just kind of cool because it's even kind of the perspective that we all gain as we grow up, and I think especially all of us being a bit more reflective coming through the pandemic, is she had that moment last year and early on in this year where it's like, you know what, I still got something left and I'm not tied to my results. Like, I've already won 2 Grand Slams, but let's play with some house money and see what else I can do. So players like that on tour are especially dangerous because, again, they're just so experienced, not just on the court, but between the ears in the game. So, I mean, she didn't even play her best tennis. Like, even post-match yesterday after winning the championship, and she was asked about how Patrick would feel about the win. And she said, well, even though I didn't play my best, I hope he's still proud of me. So there's someone who only dropped 2 sets, didn't play her best, and her serve was a bit of a mess at times, and she won the tournament. So she's definitely one to look out for at the U.S. Open.
So you mentioned that next top tier of young women stars, and I think you said Layla's name in that. How do you see her return from injury? She's 19 years old, but like, what did you like about how she came back from a couple months there dealing with that injury? And did you see any fatigue as a factor of how she didn't make it too far?
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but I think, like, she's still a teenager, and I thought she looked pretty good. It was more so, and she did lose to the eventual finalist at Ad Maya in straight sets. In that round of 32. But I thought she looked pretty good. And it was actually, like, at this stage, I know you always head into a tournament and you're like, okay, we want, like, our player to win, whoever you cheer for. For Canadians, you want Fernandez to win. But I don't think that's always just a sign of success or failure. So for her, she had a really tough 3-setter against another lefty in Storm Sanders in the opening round. And she won, I think it was 6-3 in the third. And then she faces the eventual champ, who no one's won more matches since June on tour than Haddad Maya. So I think that was a really good step for Fernandez as she's coming back from injury. It's really just about trying to get more match play under her belt. Because in terms of coming back from injury, it's not just about fitness. It's about timing. It's about just decision making. It's like all of us coming back from a vacation. Like, it just takes, like, a little extra day or two or week to really find your timing mentally.
Well, I'm glad that, you know, it seems like she's got some room to grow, but she's young and she's clearly a hard worker. And you mentioned Haddad Maya. Like, I was just stunned at this girl. She never won on the WTA tour, and she upset 4 seeded players, and including a number one. what happened there, and how incredible was this run? Like, should we be expecting her to be a big breakout here?
Yeah, I think so. It was just so fun, too, because she was so positive. Mm-hmm. And I always love to cheer for good tennis, but it's also nice when, like, it seems like good people are doing well. And she really got the crowd behind her. And she was so, like, even when she beat Fernandez, the very first thing she did after shaking her hand and even before, like, shaking the chair umpire's hand was say sorry to the crowd. Mm. She's like, oh, sorry that I beat your player. I'm really sorry about that. And then even after she beat Swiatek, it was, oh, sorry, I know you were cheering for her. But so, yeah, it's a name that's not so familiar, especially a week ago wasn't so familiar, especially to the casual tennis mm-hmm. fan. But even though it seems really sudden, and relatively speaking, it is in this calendar year. In the last few months, I mean, she won two grass court titles in Birmingham and Nottingham, and she's been playing really, really well. So she's in the top 20 now. So that means that she even has more favorable draws headed into the U.S. Open. So, yeah, I think we'll be seeing a lot more of her. She just has so much power from the baseline, and her serve's so big and can get her out of trouble. So hopefully the success continues.
So another Canadian that I know I was cheering for, I got to see her play her first match, Bianca, when she made her return here. What did you make of her tournament? Three matches, eventually falling. I think it was that same Wednesday that you saw Serena. What was it just like to see her return after she's won here?
Yeah, I think it was tough for her. Like, she was genuinely really excited to come home and play. But I think that it comes with a lot of just extra stuff, if you will. Like, it's all eyes are on you. It's the first time playing on that court since she won 3 years ago. A lot of people haven't seen her since. And we saw that in that first match against Daria Kazakina, which was a really, like, tough match. That's the 11th seed. And that was when she was needing to have the physio come out. That's when she sat down in that first set tiebreak. And afterwards, she said she didn't know if it was her stomach, she's feeling nauseous, or if it was stress. And after that emotional match, she seemed even more reserved in the next two matches, just in terms of how she usually is so animated towards the crowd and kind of letting them in. But I thought it was a really positive week for her. And again, in terms of, like, yeah, you want to win the tournament, but at this stage, she also wants to get matches in. Like, she played more tennis, more time on court than anyone after three rounds. So now the question mark is, she just withdrew from Cincinnati and she cited schedule change.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, so I'm not sure, because usually if it's an injury, you would just say, like, it's an abdominal strain or something like that. So schedule change, I'm not sure. I haven't really heard that, not to say it's an excuse, but I haven't heard a schedule change very often, because it's not like there's another tournament that she could be playing.
Right.
So I'm sure we'll get some more clarity from her once the U.S. Open starts, assuming she'll still play in that. But I really hope she does, because I thought she looked really good, and she was up against really tough opponents in Cornet, who she faced in the second round. She was coming off some bad losses against her. And then Zhang is this, like, 19-year-old who just burst onto the scene that was really good. So overall, I think it was a really positive week for Bianca, but just in terms of the motions of returning home, and you even have to think of all the, like, sponsor obligations that she had. Like, it's a really busy week. And while it can be fun, I think it can also be pretty tiring.
It's funny, because I had her on our show here about the day that Serena announced her retirement, 5 minutes after Serena announced her retirement. I had to tell her, and it was interesting just to get her initial responses. But I did ask her a lot about what it's like playing here in Canada, back home in Toronto. And not only did she have to come on my show, she does Timid Friends. She has a lot of sponsorship things to do. And she spun that as an exciting positive, but also that she's very much in tune with the mental side of her game now. And she knows what she needs, and she knows what she can handle. Have you been impressed with her demeanor and kind of her honesty going through all these, like, mental hurdles that she's had to face?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that she said to me is, it was after she took the 6 months off at the end of last year and headed into this year and came back in the spring. And she said that I asked her how her relationship with tennis is, and she said that it's healthier now. So she explained it as, it used to be that she would tie her worth, which is very easy to do, to her results. And if you think, too, of a young, like, bursting onto the scene as a teenager and you win the U.S. Open, it's not just that, like, you're thinking, like, oh, my gosh, I'm great. This is great. I'm a champion. But it's also, especially in the age of social media, is everyone else is telling you the same. And that's the expectation. And then, as she said, when she would experience losses, she would take that personally. It was like she wasn't any good. So she said that's what's really changed for her in the last year, is that she is able to separate her worth from how the tennis results come in. So I think that's really healthy. But I think, like, she's a big proponent of mental health. And I think that's also a reminder, though, is it's still a process. Like, it's, as we all are, it's kind of figuring out how we operate, what tools we can best use to help us moving forward. And I think she's, like all of us, still very much in that process. But it's just been it's been really neat. You kind of forget how young she still is in her early 20s, that she is really dealing with this publicly and wanting to make sure that she's vocal publicly so that it helps others.
Yeah, I think it's really great, especially at that young age, to take on that type of honesty, because she's mentioned it many times that she wants that next generation of tennis players to understand what she has gone through. And, you know, as you put it, there's ups and downs, and not everyone just wins and continues on that streak. It's tough with the roller coaster that can be professional sports. Did you think that she was back to full physical health when you saw her?
Yeah, I thought she looked pretty fit, especially considering, as I said, that after the three rounds, she'd played more tennis and been on court more than any other player. But yeah, I was a little concerned for that against Kazakhina at first, and I thought maybe that was just before she kind of gave an explanation post-match. While we're calling the match, I was thinking, oh, maybe it's like, is this a little bit of fitness? It's hard to tell, but I think she looked pretty good. So that's why it's even a bit of a concern she's not playing Cincinnati, just for the fact that there's no other time for her to be on court in match play ahead of the U.S. Open. But yeah, I thought all things considered, she looked good.
Okay, hopefully we find out what schedule conflicts mean. I don't really get it. Okay, one more. I got to ask you a hockey question before we go. Where is Nazem Kadri going to sign?
Oh, my gosh.
And do you have any information for us? Because we're waiting.
I have absolutely none. I find you after the National Bank Open, I have, like, no idea what's going on.
Well, he hasn't signed yet, and nobody knows anything. So, like, help. I thought maybe you'd have – you got to get Elliot on the line, okay?
I am an awful insider.
Well, it's been interesting to cover. No comments on the Nazem Kadri front. Hopefully we'll get some of that too. Do you take any time off now before the NHL season comes back, or are you still grinding?
No, I have some time off, which is
okay,
really
good.
Nice.
Well, enjoy that. Appreciate you coming on one day after your exhausting week. I really appreciated this insight. And we'll get some hockey talk from you once you've had some time to recuperate.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
he hasn't had his day with the cup, though. I remember seeing that during the tennis. He was like, well, I think it's coming soon in London.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Maybe I'll go check it out.
I go to London.
Yeah. Oh, it's close. Hey, you went to school in London, so you're a local.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, Carolyn, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye, Eilish. Have a good one.
Thanks so much. Carolyn Cameron, play-by-play announcer for the National Bank Open. And obviously, she does all her hockey stuff here, too. But she was in the tennis grind. It was really great to see how great Sportsnet did covering National Bank Open. I really enjoyed watching it. I really enjoyed attending it. And the Bianca thing is interesting. I actually just saw on Twitter, which is also interesting, Jeannie Bouchard is making her tennis comeback after 17 months away from the sport. She played in a doubles tournament. I have not thought about Jeannie Bouchard in over a year and a half, possibly. She hasn't played since suffering a shoulder injury of March last year. So super interested to see what her return is. She was once ranked as high as number 5 back in 2014. Been a little bit of a quiet time for Jeannie Bouchard, hoping that she is successful in her return. Be like great to see some more Canadians in the mix. We'll just keep our eyes on Jeannie. After the break, we are going to talk to James Sharman, who is our Sportsnet soccer analyst and obviously the founder of Sharman's Proper Pies. If you don't know about that, we'll definitely talk about it. Talk a little bit of TFC, and then afterwards set up tonight, Jays and Orioles, Kikuchi. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. The English Hour. You can download all previous 3 hours of the Fan Morning Show wherever you get your podcasts. Like, subscribe, 5 stars. One Toronto team bringing the joy right now for fans. Toronto FC. We got James Sharman, Sportsnet soccer analyst and founder of Sharman's Proper Pies, joining us this morning. Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. You know what I just realized is I don't think I've ever gotten the story of Sharman's Proper Pies. So please inform me.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Very quickly. Just pre-pandemic, looking for a plan B, just in case, you know, the whole media thing, yeah. you know, went crazy, you know, crazy thought, I know, a little bit volatile, that industry. Me and my wife just thought about a product, and around the same time, her mum stayed with us. She was a great baker and sold pies in Alberta at farmers markets. So we thought, huh, there's an idea. So I went to pie school with her, learned how to cook pies.
Wow.
And then we started a farmers market up, and then it kind of grew from there. The pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. We opened up our own store on the Danforth, and it kind of exploded from there. So, yeah, it's been a quick few years, shall we say, with some challenges along the way. But overall, it's been great. A nice alternative to media all the time.
That's right. It's good to have a little passion project,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
You can't just listen to us talk about TFC unless it's good right now, which it is. How great are the vibes right now around TFC?
Yeah, that's a great point because, I mean, for the last number of years, there's been some moments, obviously, some good moments. But overall, it's been a decline since they won that championship. And this season, the hopes return with the big signings. I was actually at a game this weekend in the stands. Mm-hmm. Hadn't been there for a while. And there is that real energy there. It's back for sure. A real belief this team can do something pretty special. And as much as they're, you know, still, you know, behind the eight ball, so to speak, in the standings this year, the way they play, the fans appreciate good quality football. The fan base has grown so much. Now it's sophisticated. They know what good football is. And they really believe that this team is on the verge of something pretty special. It may not be this year, but the ownership's committed. They've got the right management in place. And they've got superstars, you know. And this team and this city loves its superstars, right? So I would say very much... It's not quite the Giovinco years just yet, but I think on the horizon we could be getting there.
So the superstars, the new Italian duos, TFC's been unbeaten in four games since they took the field, 10 out of possible 12 points. How much do these, I know Insigne and Bernardeschi, obviously they are great players on their own individually, but how much are they elevating the play of their teammates right now?
That's the point. Absolutely. They're doing just that. It's amazing how you bring in a couple of, you know, almost world-class players, if not world-class players, how everyone around them improves. And we're really seeing that, not just on the games, but you hear from the training staff in the training sessions. They're just more intense. They're better quality. People are learning from these players. We're seeing Bernardeschi, for example, on the weekend, talking to some of the younger players, Jaden Nelson, for example, educating them on the field, pointing, directing. It makes a huge difference. And just making those runs that perhaps other players wouldn't be making. Now, there's an adjustment that comes with that, right, Eilish? I mean, not everyone will straight away understand where to put the ball when there's a world-class player on the field with you, but that will come in time. And we're seeing that adjustment right now. And that's what it is. It's a real adjustment to the quality and the IQ these players present. But you're seeing it over and over. A player like Jonathan Osorio has been one that stood out to me. A guy that is just simply, he was always very good. He's had a great season, but he can play at that level with those players. He's been a guy that seamlessly has found his way once again and puts the ball in the right position, makes the right runs as well. So, yeah, I think you're seeing not just the, you know, the influx of talent with those players, but you're seeing the rest of the team elevate themselves as well.
It's great that you mentioned Osorio because we actually had him on the show last week, and, you know, I'm trying to get some quotes out of him. How great have you been playing as of late? Like, what's been changing? And he's like, the team, this. So I'm going to ask you the same question. He's got 9 goals on the season, 3 in his last 2 matches. What has been clicking so well for him?
Yeah, no, Ozo is the most modest player, right? The modest guy. he's always been good, right? He's had a great TFC career. He's played more games than anyone else. He is a player that has got better and better every year. He's had his struggles at times, you know, he's lost his position at times, but he's always found a way back. He's shown great resiliency, and you're just seeing him grow and mature as a footballer now. He knows his place, he's got that confidence, and like I said before, he plays so well with those top quality players. I think honestly, when you look back on the history of TFC, he is one of the faces of this franchise from day one. He is one of the biggest names, and he'll be, I think, one day embossed in bronze outside the stadium when they start, you know, doing that with these players. He has to. He's that good. And he's playing out of his skin right now. And it's interesting because he's coming up on a new contract. Will he stay? Will he move? He's always thought about Europe. You know, is that an option for him? Give it a try at least. And he's at a point now where, I think he's 28 now. It's probably his last chance to make that move. Would be coming up this off season, so I do wonder if he's even around next year. I hope he is for TFC's faithful because he's wonderful, but at the same time, I'd love to see him try and play his trade in Europe, just see how good he can get.
That's really tough to hear because obviously, you know, he's a staple to this, but you want him to succeed as an athlete and achieve, you know, what's the next level for him. How much do you think that weighs on players midseason? Are they able to just bubble in what is happening now, even with the World Cup attending, like down the road? Are they able to say, let's try to make the playoffs right now? Or is there that little bit of inkling in the back of their mind that this could help me still down the road?
Yeah, well, you look at Richie Larea, right? It's a great example. He's a guy that was arguably the best fullback in MLS. And then in January, he leaves and goes to England to try and play his trade at Nottingham Forest, a really good team in the Championship, not the Premier League, the Championship. And he joins a team that's just bossing it. And they win promotion. He doesn't get really any minutes because he's playing behind a very good player called Jed Spence. And through no fault of his own, he didn't get the playing time he wanted. Pre-season comes around. They sign more defenders in his position, and he sees a writing on the wall. Now, there's a World Cup coming up, right, as you mentioned there. He needs playing time. So can he stay in England? There were options for him, but not guaranteed playing time or minutes. So he comes back to Toronto on loan, and he's hit the ground running. He's been absolutely fantastic in two games, a better player than he left. But he made that move. It didn't work out for him, and he now knows minutes are more important than anything for him. So I wonder if Ozo looks at that. You know, him and Richie are very close. They're good friends. I do wonder if they have conversations about, is it better just to stay with what you know and get your guaranteed minutes or try? I think a player like Jonathan Osorio has that burning desire, that ambition to see how good he can get. I think he'll at least entertain the option of moving overseas in the winter. So we'll wait and see. But yeah, the World Cup's definitely an option, you know, and a factor, because you do need playing time. And you know, Canada's at a point now with the depth they have that, you know, John Herdman won't just pick you just for the sake of it. He needs you to be playing, you know, good minutes, quality minutes for your team leading up to that World Cup.
So you mentioned Richie Larea, and he's, you know, I think easily made an immediate impact for TFC with all these new players in flux. How has he changed, like, the complexion of the team since he's been here?
Yeah, huge. I mean, listen, it's just been two games, right? But he looks like he never left, only he's actually a better player now. And one issue with TFC from half of the season was they were playing a lot of young players, often out of position, and it's great for their development. And I think down the road, they'll look back at this season and say, wow, that was really, really beneficial for our kids. But at right back, they were struggling. They're playing, you know, Jaquil Marshall-Ruddy there at times, who's going to be an absolute star, but that's not his natural position. He was learning it. So in comes Richie Larea, who is probably the best right back in MLS. I'd say the best fullback in MLS, but then on the left-hand side, you have Domenico Crisciuto, who's just arrived from Italy, who I think might have become the best fullback in MLS. So yeah, he's changed it. They've got such balance now throughout the entire lineup. There isn't really a weakness in that side. The concern may have been at centre-back, but Chris Mavinga's come in the last couple of games and has looked like the Chris Mavinga of old. So again, player elevating his ability. So I think Richie coming on that right-hand side, you know, combining so well with Bernardeschi, just is frightening, I think, for most teams in MLS. And if they get to the playoffs, and it's still a big if, it's four points gap, you know, watch out for those two being absolutely key components in the playoffs.
Okay, so playoffs. They're 4 points back of the final playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. 9 matches remaining. It feels much more in reach with the little streak that they're on, but is this still a tangible and an achievable goal for them?
Yeah, you know, it really is. I'm a believer now. The fact of the matter is, it's 4 points, which isn't a lot, but you have four teams between you and the playoffs, right? So you have to overcome those four teams. The bright point of that is that they are playing Miami. They are still playing New England coming up, and they are playing Charlotte coming up. You know, teams that stand in their way. So, you know, it's easy to say just win those games, but if they win those games, then it's a very different situation. I think it's possible. You know, 4 points in 9 games, it's not easy. They have dug themselves a hole, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, just because the way the schedule works, they can really recoup some of those points in the next month or so. So it's absolutely possible. Mm-hmm. And if they do make it, that'll be a team that everyone wants to avoid because, you know, it is – MLS is weird, right? It's just getting to the show. It really is. There's so much parity in this league. You just get to the playoffs, anything can happen. We saw Seattle do it a couple of years ago now. We've seen Toronto do it before as well. Two very different seasons. Just get to the show and see what happens.
And everyone loves an underdog, right? So I think that's a good spot to be in at times. So out of all those teams that they still have to face and that are fighting for that final playoff spot, which team scares you the most in terms of not letting this happen for TFC?
Yeah, you know, I look at the league as a whole. You know, I mean, does anyone scare me from TFC's perspective? I don't think anyone would scare them. And you watch the way that team, you know, plays now with that swagger, with an Asini and a Bernadeschi have seen it all in one of the best leagues in world football. They're not scared of anyone. LAFC, I know Philadelphia's playing great football. They've been incredible this year, just three losses. But LAFC is the one comparable to TFC with the star value as well. What they're doing, dominating MLS right now. They wouldn't obviously meet them to a potential final, and let's not get ahead of ourselves. But that's the team certainly that would raise some eyebrows. I mean, from a fan standpoint, seeing an LAFC-TFC final, and here I am getting way ahead of myself, it makes me salivate as a football fan. That is great. That would be great for the league, I think. But yeah, as far as the fear factor, I think this team now is so different to what it was, you know, 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago. It's a different mindset entirely. They're scared of no one.
Okay, last one before I let you go. I've been making some parallels or some observations between one Toronto team and the other. Obviously, the Blue Jays had more of a quiet trade deadline, and they haven't really felt like they went all in at this point. And the other side of it, TFC has added some significant names at this midway point of their season. Do you think that gives the players a little bit of a positive boost that, hey, this is our season and the management believes in it? Because on the other side, we've thought maybe the Blue Jays are suffering from a little bit of, disappointment.
Yeah, it's a really good point, a good question, because I think we see that at every trade deadline. When you see an ownership group, be it in NHL, MLB, NBA, you know, going all in and backing the players they have, you hear the players talk about that, and they say, yeah, we have that lift now. We've got the backing of our ownership. They must believe in us. That's great. And so you do wonder whether the Jays are like, well, you know, they can't really be into us that much, whereas TFC, they now know. This is a different club. They want us to win. They'll commit what needs to be done. They've committed the most money to any player in MLS history in Lorenzo Insigne. Bernadeschi isn't cheap. They bring in Domenico Crescito, you know, for less money perhaps, but a guy that's done it all in international football. So, I really think that's a great point. I think that they have no excuses now, put it that way. I think that's what it comes down to. There's no excuses. They can't now say, well, you know, we didn't really get what we wanted at the trade deadline. No one's revamped their team like TFC have mid-season. It's incredible what they've done, really. A really great job. So no excuses now. Just get the job done on the field, and now it's up to the players.
Well, a little bit of pressure on that, but they still have lots of time, hopefully, to gain some ground in the standings. James, I appreciate you joining this morning. We'll get an update from you in a week or two.
Great. Ellis, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. James Sharman, Sportsnet soccer analyst and founder of Sharman's Proper Pies, which I need to get some of those ordered. So you can actually check out his website. He has a whole website about his proper pies. As I say, yeah, Toronto just keeps on winning. Just since that Italian duo took the field, they've just invigorated their lineup. They look like a completely different team. They're back in action on Wednesday against New England, so you don't have to wait too long to see them. I think they also play on Saturday. So a busy week for Toronto sports fans. Speaking of Toronto sports fans, the Blue Jays. So the Blue Jays, obviously things are not ideal, to put it nicely. They've lost six of their last nine games. They've seen their wild card grasp start to disappear in that time span. Mariners have now overtaken them. The Orioles, the Rays, and Twins are all within striking distance. There's a little bit of a knot. They're continuing to play the Orioles, which seems like it's half of their schedule is against the Orioles, continuing down the stretch here. They're 1-4 against the Orioles and Guardians on the stretch. They've dropped to 30-40 against teams who are 500 or better. That seems to be the big narrative right now, is why are the Blue Jays so bad against good teams? Because all you have to play basically from this stretch is good teams. Certainly a concern. We talk about concern indexes a lot on our show, and that one seems to be mighty high. They also haven't won back-to-back August games. It's August 15th. Basically play every day with a couple of rest days. It's also concerning. So a tough week is looming. Baltimore Orioles arriving for three games starting today. And then a four-game set with the Yankees, who they're 4-8 against right after. It's kind of that make or break stretch, really, for the Blue Jays. I think we've said this before. There was a stretch in July that felt like a must-win stretch. This is increasingly important as you see what's happening with the bullpen, the lack of confidence that a lot of people are feeling with Berríos, as he saw once again this weekend, not the $150+ million pitcher that you signed. And tonight we have Kikuchi on the mound. The track record has obviously not been great. Big opportunity to change that narrative, though, which I love. As we just talked about with James Sharman, you love a good comeback. You love a good underdog story. Kikuchi could benefit from that tonight. I'm just saying, it's an opportunity. You obviously have Blair and Barker next after the Ailish Hour, and then Jays Talk Plus in the afternoon. Big week ahead. I'm sure they'll be talking a lot about the Berríos start and what can be done with him. Also, Canada and Finland. So Canada's doing extremely well at the World Championships, obviously. I don't know if the attendance or the coverage has been as great as expected. First of all, mid-summer ice hockey tournament, not a lot of people are tuning into that. Plus the entire Hockey Canada debacle, not a lot of people are tuning into that. But they are doing quite well. Last game, Kent Johnson pulled off the Michigan. You know that move where they wrap the puck around, put it top corner. He pulled that off in the World Juniors. That's pretty cool. Take a look at that online. And then Mason McTavish has just been absolutely outstanding. He's got the tournament leading 6th goal, 10 points, and a plus minus of +9. He's more than halfway to the all-time Canadian record for points in a single World Juniors. Braden Schenn holds that with 18. He's an Anaheim Ducks prospect, and we talked about this last week with Sam Cosentino. He's a guy that's going to fit seamlessly in the NHL. He almost looks like he's too good to be at this tournament. Great for Canadian fans. They're playing tonight against Finland at 6 p.m. Finland's going on a back-to-back tonight. Finland obviously has always been kind of in the conversation as a good hockey opponent when it's a Canada-USA heavy matchup, as Sam put it. Finland could be sneaky. Sweden could be sneaky too, but they're going back with a back-to-back tonight. Canada's got the rest day. The last time these guys faced was New Year's Eve 2020. Feels like a long time ago. Canada won 4-1, but Finland's been pretty spicy on the power play. They're 8-for-13 in their first 3 games with the man advantage, so hopefully Canada can stay out of the box. One of those type of matchups where you're looking for that little bit of edge. Canada's offense is incredibly strong, as I mentioned. Mason McTavish basically single-handedly owning this tournament, but if you're looking for a way that Finland could find an edge, that could be it. Obviously, there's some Toronto Maple Leafs in the lineup for Finland. That'll be another reason to tune in tonight. If you're looking to mix up your Blue Jays watching, you got Finland and Canada at 6 p.m. Okay, so another great feel-good story that happened out of the World Juniors was Latvia defeating Czechia for their first ever preliminary round victory at the World Juniors. First ever. So previously, they had gone 0-27. In the prelims. The last time that they actually won at the World Juniors was in relegation, so that doesn't count. That was a 2-1 win over Denmark in 2012. So even that win, which isn't counting towards this preliminary record, was back in 2012. So an upset, really, as Latvia is only in the tournament this time around because Russia and Belarus were unable to attend. They were not invited. The Latvian fan base, the Latvian team, just it was incredible to see. We have a little audio clip of them celebrating. If you haven't had a chance to look at this celebration online, I recommend it. It's really great to see how passionate they are, and it's a really good success story. That's just their on-ice celebration. Their off-ice celebration, equally as great. You got some footage from inside the locker room. Since they're World Juniors, that's a PG type of celebration. But really, really cool to see. I know that JD, my co-host, has Latvian roots, so he would be very happy that I'm giving this story some time on air. There's no way that he's listening. He's probably already asleep because he doesn't have to do the Hela shower. But a very special Latvian win. I actually got a chance to go to the World Championships last year in the bubble, the World Championship, not the World Juniors, in Latvia. That was really cool. I was covering it for IHF. I got to be immersed in the Latvian culture in the bubble, which was a very unique experience. You didn't get to go out to Riga and check out, you know, the city much. It was a bubble. But I did get to meet and interact with a lot of Latvian fans and a lot of Latvian staff. And I have to say, an incredible country, wonderful people. The Latvian team was one of my favorites to interact with and cover. So I was covering the game for their social media, for their stats, all their video, everything. We had a very small team. So you're kind of doing everything. And being in the arena in Latvia was awesome. There was one game in this closed bubble where they let Latvian fans in. They kind of went, all right, we're halfway through the tournament. Let's open the bubble up a bit to spectators. And so it was the Latvians on home ice in a must-win game. And this arena isn't a massive arena. It's, I don't know, maybe the size of Coca-Cola Coliseum for reference. And I had headphones in the whole game because I have to listen to the feed. It was deafening, the sound of these Latvian fans. They came in face paint, flags, tarps off. Like, no wonder JD is Latvian, because they're big tarps off nation. Painting on their chests, Viking outfits. Just, it was honestly one of the coolest sporting events I'd ever been to, was watching Latvia on home ice at the World Championships. And they had an incredible tournament. If you remember, they beat the Canadians, which I was there for, obviously, which was, I had to be very unbiased, and that was tough. They beat the Canadians to start the tournament. They went on this incredible run, and they ended up losing that game, the only game with fans in the stands, which was devastating. But they were a class act. They were really awesome to interact with. So a little soft spot for Latvia, especially seeing them win their first ever game at the World Juniors. A really, really special story. So they won't, I don't think that they're going to have any chance in this tournament, but Canada, Finland, that is tonight. Take a look at that. And the Toronto Blue Jays, obviously, with their 7-0-7 start, three-game series against the Orioles. And then they're in New York. So let's get this started on a good foot. One other piece of news that came out this weekend, unconfirmed news, but nonetheless, it comes from Shams Charania, who, you know, he's a pretty reputable guy from The Athletic. He broke the news of what the NBA's Christmas schedule will be. Five-game slate, featuring eight playoff teams from last year, including the Knicks and the Lakers, as the additional. Sunday, also they're going to go up against NFL Sunday. And we've had this debate on how is this going to work. That's just when Christmas Day is. So Milwaukee Bucks and Boston Celtics, Philadelphia 76ers and the New York Knicks, the Phoenix Suns at the Denver Nuggets, the Lakers and the Dallas Mavericks, and the Grizzlies and the Golden State Warriors. Obviously an intrigued, packed slate with the Bucks and Celtics setting up that holiday stage in a matchup of the two Eastern Conference champions and the betting favorites in the East, and then a rematch of the most contentious playoff series with the Grizzlies and the Warriors. So going to be incredible viewing. One note is that the Brooklyn Nets obviously nowhere to be found in this Christmas Day slate. What's going to happen with Durant and Kyrie Irving? Probably why that the NFL and NBA didn't want to include this team. That still has no resolution, what Kevin Durant's up to. I'm sure in the next couple of weeks, we're going to get more NBA news. Can't wait to get the Raptors back in there. Can't wait for our Raptors shows to return. I've been missing some content on that side. So tonight, World Juniors, Blue Jays. That's your lineup. Thanks for listening to the Ailish Hour today. Thanks to James Sharman and Caroline Cameron. And we will talk to you tomorrow.